that is cheating.
Well, John Nichols, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
I appreciate it. It's a pleasure to talk to you, my friend.
I'm Jesse DeGroote, the marketing representative for the Mack Hayden Theater in Chatham, New York, and you're in tune to 90.7 FM, WGXC, ICRA.
All right, all together now. Ready?
All Together Now is a new evening news show brought to you by WGXC in Greene and Columbia Counties and WOOC in Troy. The show is a unique, community-based collaboration between listeners and programmers, both on air and off. If you want to get involved, send us an email at info@wgxc.org. WGXC always needs computer donations. If you have an old one you don't need, and it's either a Macintosh 2011 or newer 2.0 gigahertz or faster CPU, dual core or more, or Windows 2012 or newer 2.4 gigahertz or faster CPU, dual core or more, email info@wgxc.org for more information.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by the First Presbyterian Church of Hudson, a faith community open to all. Whether you are single, married, divorced, gay, wealthy, poor, or no habla inglés, if you are just browsing, just woke up, or just got out of jail, it doesn't matter if you work on Wall Street or if you sleep on Wall Street, you belong. We love soccer moms, crying babies, vegans, hipsters, seekers and doubters, tourists and locals. All are welcome. Services held Sunday mornings at 10:45 a.m. You can find us on the web at firstpreshudson.org.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you a special news bulletin.
Stay tuned to this station.
Stand by for news.
Direct via satellite from our on-the-spot task force.
Good evening from our newsroom in New York.
This is
Daily News and Weather Report.
We take you now to
this radio broadcast.
You are tuned in to All Together Now, a collaborative one-hour news show for community radio stations in the Capital Region and New York's Hudson Valley. All Together Now features contributions from the public, along with programmers at WOOC in Troy and WGXC in ACRA, featuring local and regional news, weather updates, and newsmaker interviews.
Service Daily Newscast for Wednesday, December the 12th, 2018. I'm Mike Clifford. President Trump clashes with Democrats and threatens a government shutdown if he doesn't get his border wall. Also, on the Wednesday rundown, lawmakers agree on an $867 billion farm bill. Plus, a new report finds private community correction centers are failing to rehabilitate. Topping our news, prior to his meeting with Representative Nancy Pelosi and Senator Chuck Schumer, President Trump brought reporters into the Oval Office and, as Axios reports, in an extended heated exchange before the cameras clashed with the two Democratic leaders over congressional support for funding for his border wall. During the tense encounter, Trump declared he is proud to shut down the government for border security. Axios notes that Trump demanded $5 billion for the border wall, but Schumer has drawn a red line on providing no more than $1.3 billion. After the meeting, Schumer said this temper tantrum will not get him his wall, and it will hurt a lot of people because he will cause a shutdown. People who use and value farming conservation practices are applauding parts of the U.S. Senate's newly passed farm bill. Ross Brown reports they think the legislation will benefit beginning farmers and help sustain the vitality of rural communities.
The Conservation Stewardship Program, which pays farmers who enter into multi-year contracts with the government to implement conservation practices, remains in place, although its long-term funding was reduced. Anna Johnson with the Center for Rural Affairs says she's encouraged that the bill will continue many programs Midwestern farmers have come to rely on.
Increased support for key practices like cover crops and resource conserving crop rotations, but the way it's set up and divvied up, CSP, the Conservation Stewardship Program, is going to be at a disadvantage going into the next farm bill, and funding is going to decrease over time.
She adds one disappointment was a decision to expand rather than close loopholes that allow mega farms to collect even higher payments.
That legislation will now head to the House and, if passed, to the president for his signature. The state of Massachusetts now has one of the toughest laws restricting non-compete clauses in work contracts, and it looks like they'll be a lot less common at businesses in the state.
One reason is the so-called garden leave, a unique part of the Commonwealth law. If a worker signs a non-compete, the employer will have to pay them part of their wages after they leave the job to offset the inconvenience of leaving. And it applies to both employees and contractors. So, attorney Josh Davis, who specializes in employment law, says businesses are thinking twice about including non-compete clauses in contracts.
The law makes them more expensive than they used to be. It's not something you just do anymore. And for a long period of time, in Massachusetts and in other jurisdictions, it really was something that employers just did. You know, you want to work here, you need to sign this. Now I think there's a little more thought about who should be bound and why it makes sense.
Davis says a lot of business owners are asking whether the law applies to contracts that were signed before it went into effect on October 1st. The answer is no. The law was passed in Massachusetts after complaints that non-compete clauses were being overused, making it much harder for people in many fields to find a job after leaving one. I'm Laura Ross-Brautelum reporting.
Massachusetts joins just a few other states that limit non-compete clauses. California still has the strictest policy, banning almost all non-compete agreements. And the negative reaction from conservation groups was swift to a Trump administration proposal to remove federal clean water protections for many smaller streams and wetlands.
On Tuesday, the EPA announced a replacement for the Waters of the United States rule. It would lift federal protections from water sources that are seasonal and from wetlands that are not connected by a stream to a larger body of water. Jennifer Collins with the law firm Earth Justice says the proposal ignores the basic science of hydrology.
All water is connected. So whether it's a small stream that only runs part of the year or a wetland that isn't directly connected to a larger body of water, they feed into the larger bodies of water that are the drinking water sources for millions of people across the country.
Acting EPA Administrator Andrew Wheeler called the original Obama-era rule government overreach and said the new rule gives power back to the states, reducing red tape for farmers and other landowners. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
If that rule is finalized, multiple conservation groups have already vowed to take the fight to the courts. And finally, Andrea Sears reports it's no fun to be locked up during the holidays, especially when a new report says private correction centers are failing to rehabilitate.
Community correction centers serve as halfway houses where some people serve out the end of their prison sentences. There are 14 publicly run centers in Pennsylvania, and 38 are privately run. The study in the December edition of the Prison Journal says the cost per day to house a person in public or private facilities is virtually identical. But report author Terrence Aladdin says those held in the private centers are far more likely to reoffend after release than those in the publicly run facilities.
What our study found is that inmates or offenders who come out of the private correction centers are four times as likely to reoffend than those who come out of the public systems.
He says factors like better training of staff, the availability of rehabilitative programs, and higher levels of care at publicly run centers contribute to better outcomes.
In Pennsylvania, the Department of Corrections has promoted a plan that would grant private residential community correction centers that reduce recidivism additional funding while penalizing those that do not. I'm Mike Clifford. Thanks for newsing and cruising with Public News Service. We are member and listener supported, and we're online at publicnewsservice.org.
The National Weather Service in Albany predicts a mostly sunny Wednesday with a high of just 33 and a low around 14. Thursday, there's a 20% chance of snow showers. Otherwise, it should be partly sunny with a high near 28 and a low around 23. Friday, there's a slight chance of rain after 1 p.m. with a high near 39 and a low around 35. I'm Tom Rowe for WJXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, listener-supported, creative radio for open ears.
Thank you. You've tuned in to All Together Now, WGXC's regional look at the news from Hudson Valley and the Capital Region, from the Catskills to the Berkshires and beyond. I'm Tom Rowe, and today you'll hear all sorts of local news updates, weather, interviews, and more, plus community events and the song of the day on All Together Now.
This is the news. This is the network. Network. This is the news. This is the news. This is the news. This is the network. Network.
On air, in air, waves controlled. On air, in air, channel connection. And the moon turns to blood.
From Amateur Radio Newsline Report, number 2145, these are the Ham Nation headlines for Wednesday, December 12, 2018. The newest amateur radio satellite is now in beacon mode. Newsline anchor Neil Rapp, WB9VPG, has more.
At different times of the day, depending on where you are in the world, you might point your HT skyward. Tune it to 145.920 and hear this.
Box 1 quest. Safe mode.
That voice beacon also has a telemetry stream, sending back data to AMSAT North America using subaudible tones, giving the status of the Fox One Cliff satellite, which was among numerous ham radio satellites, launched on December 3rd from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. It was activated a few hours later. Paul Stetzer, N8HM, the executive vice president of AMSAT North America, told Newsline that it's still in the testing phase, so it's for listening only. Sometime after the second week of December, AMSAT hopes to enable operations on the 70-centimeter and 23-centimeter uplink frequencies as well, but not just yet. Meanwhile, hams are encouraged to listen for this transmission of initial telemetry with the beacon on the satellite's passes, and then join the more than 110 amateurs around the world who already have uploaded details to the organization's servers at amsat.org.
The numbers are in for Jamboree on the Air and Internet.
Jamboree on the Air in the United States brought out 10,700 scouts, 4,005 visitors, and 266 reporting stations. This was a 36% increase in scouts and nearly 18% increase in reporting stations. It was a busy weekend for all, including those participating in Jamboree on the Internet, which saw an increase of 300% in activity. I see this as a call to the amateur radio community to double our efforts for next year. Our featured station in the report this year was K4L at Camp La Noche in Paisley, Florida, which reported, "This was our first official Jodo Jody at our camp in over a decade. We had a sold-out weekend of 1,800 Cub Scouts for Cub Halloween and Fall Festival. We set up our new 60-foot tower and used everything under the sun, HF, VHF, UHF, D-Star, DMR, and Fusion. With 5 hams and 5 to 10 helpers throughout the day, we managed to get everything through our 2 little pop-up tents." Congratulations to them and to all the other units and amateurs that helped to make this year such a great success.
Speaking of numbers, we have some telling figures about ham radio licenses in the U.S., and the news is good. Again, here's Neil Rapp.
If you're licensed in the U.S. and ever feel like you're in diminishing company, think again. Kyle Pilquist, KD0NDG, reported on his blog recently that his study of the FCC database, along with some number crunching, revealed that our hobby still enjoys good health indeed. He reports on his blog that the ratio of new members to canceled licenses is 1.4 to 1. Kyle writes, quote, "So you could say for every cancellation, we have almost 1.5 new licenses to replace that with," end quote. Although the FCC told Newsline it could not confirm the trend Kyle observed, the ARRL's Dave Isker, N1RSN, told Newsline that yes, indeed, there is a slight uptick in the number of licenses the league tracks. Dave said it might be due to the emphasis these days on STEM education and a focus on technology, along with the exposure amateur radio got during the hurricanes of 2017. Whatever the reason, we all welcome the news and the company on the air.
And that's all from the Amateur Radio Newsline, your independent source for amateur radio news for 4 decades and counting at arnewsline.org. With Neil Rapp, WB9VPG, Bill Stearns, NE4RD, Karen Eve Murray, KD2GUT at the news desk in New York, and our news team across the globe. I'm Don Wellbanks, AE5DW. 73. We'll see you next time here on Ham Nation.
Now on the line is Afia Mularkey.
Mularkey, yes.
And you are the, excuse me, I don't
see. Public Policy and Special Projects Analyst.
There you are. For Scenic Hudson. And we've got you on the line to tell us about this report that came out earlier in the week. I guess you guys commissioned the report?
Yes, we did. It's from the same independent expert that did a previous analysis for us when the EPA was working on their draft five-year review, the second five-year review for the PCB dredging project. New data was collected by New York State, sediment samples that EPA and GE had refused to collect, and New York State went out and collected them, 1,800 samples across the upper 40 miles of the project site. And we just asked Dr. Hennett to take a look at those samples and basically just tell us what is it saying. That's a highly technical report, very simple, though. There's like a one-page summary that he gave us, and he created some maps for us. And then we released those findings in our press statement earlier this week.
And so General Electric is saying that the PCBs in the Hudson River are all cleaned up, and the Hudson River is all good to go now, right? Is that what's going on?
They would like to have that dialogue, and unfortunately they're getting a little bit of a support from EPA. But as they like to say, the devil's in the details. And once you get into looking at the actual project data and what EPA's really saying, they're acknowledging that the remediation that General Electric did wasn't enough. The remedy's not protective human health and the environment, and they're way off by decades where they thought they should be within a couple years of the end of the dredging. Dredging ended in 2015, and some of the first tissue goals were in 2021. And we're way going to be going way past those first goals. And they like to say this statistic, which I think is so fascinating in the paper, that people are going to be able to eat the fish within 45 to 75 years. What this actually says is men over the age of 15 and men, especially over the age of 55, are going to be able to eat the fish. Women of childbearing age, children under the age of 15, will not be able to eat the fish for many decades to come. The problem is not how much they got out, how much they left behind. So when General Electric says we did everything we were supposed to do, what they're saying is we got out a certain amount and we're done.
And that 40 to 75 year thing is based on the previous report, right? About after they cleaned, they did their cleaning, and that doesn't to me sound like a job that's cleaned. If you can't eat fish for 40 to 75 years, and you're saying it's longer if it's a female or child, right?
Correct, and that's what we're trying to say. No one ever imagined that this cleanup was going to remove every molecule of PCBs from the river, because that's just, it's unreasonable. What the point of the project was, you were going to remove enough so the reductions in the fish tissue would come down in a much shorter time frame. So instead of being 500 years, it was going to be 20 to 55 to 65 to 75. And that was already a compromise. So, you know, we didn't get what we wanted. You know, we would have liked to have gotten a lot more PCBs out of the river and seen the fish tissue levels come down much sooner. But we didn't get that. What we got was a compromise cleanup. Okay, we're going to deal with this. We're going to set goals so we know we're on track to get to those goals. And one of the first goals is 2020, 2021, which is about 5 years after the last shovel was taken out. Well, now we're in 2018, and that we're not going to be even close to those benchmarks. We're like 300 to 600% higher in the marker species that we had expected to be at. And we actually knew this going into 2012 when they did their first five-year review of the project. And at that time, EPA was taking a chance and saying, well, we still have a few more years of dredging. We think we are going to be able to get to our goals. Now, fast forward to 2017, they do a report, a review, and said, well, it will be protective. We're just not going to make our goals, and that's okay. And we said, whoa, 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 whoa. It's not okay to say you're not going to reach your goals. We already had a compromise cleanup, and now you're telling the public we're going to compromise on the compromise. It's not okay.
And can you tell us just how dangerous the PCBs are for humans and for the wildlife?
Well, it's interesting because it's a cumulative impact. It's not an immediate effect. It's living by the river. The volatilization is still under some scrutiny, but new studies have come out saying it's more dangerous than what they originally thought. It's eating the fish for the cleanup. The exposure pathway is eating the fish. So the goal is to either catch the fish, cut the poison out, and then eat what remains, or don't eat any at all. And that the goal of the cleanup was, we shouldn't have to live like that. We're living beside of a river that should be used as a resource for sustenance, if nothing else, and we can't do that. So exposure to PCBs through fish, especially for human beings, it's cancer-causing. And I would like to note that since the ROB was issued for the Hudson River PCB project, it used to be a probable carcinogen, which means pretty closely linked to several different types of cancers. Since that time, it's come out and said it is a known carcinogen. There's also an interesting correlation between PCBs and certain neurological disorders associated with autism and those types of things, because PCBs stay in the body, especially in the body fat, and they cross the fetal barrier. This is especially harmful for the wildlife who are relying solely on PCB-contaminated, you know, other species in the river that they eat.
And
especially
so,
the mink species.
So mothers that have PCB built up in their system over years, are they passing that down to the children? Is that?
Yeah, they can, yes. That's why women of childbearing age are told not to have any contact or eat any fish from the Hudson River at all.
And is it just a problem in with the PCBs in Saratoga County in the Hudson River, or does it flow down to Coxsackie and to Athens and to
all the way down to New York Harbor? The Army Corps of Engineers for New York Harbor has to maintain that harbor. It's a huge economic boon for the entire country, not just New York State. So they're the ones responsible for dredging. And the PCBs they remove from the harbor, the estimates are 50 to 70% of the PCBs come directly from General Electric. It's a legacy pollution after many years of, you know, untold amount that's being dumped. There's a number that floats around the media that everyone always laughs because they know I'm going to jump right on it. It's 1.3 million pounds. So you designed a cleanup that said GE estimates 1.3 million pounds was dumped. If you ask General Electric, if you asked EPA, where did that 1.3 million pound number come from that you designed this project around, they'll tell you, we don't know, it's a made-up number. Rough estimates says 5 to 9 million pounds of PCBs were dumped into the river. So you have a project that was designed to not clean up a critical amount of PCBs. And they're heavy, they volatilize, and they mix with water. I call PCBs the world's most toxic traveler because of the way that they can change.
And how did this when it was going on, were they backing up cartoon trucks that said PCBs on the side of them and pouring them into the river, or was it like runoff from how were they poisoning the river when it was going on?
Well, one, GE likes to say that they had permits to do it. They did not. When it was regulated, they exceeded their permits all the time. Runoff was definitely one of that in the factories, and there's always been rumors, not proven in a court of law, but if you talk to people who live upriver, they will definitely tell you stories about having trucks show up at the house, money exchange hands, and barrels disappear. We know that PCBs were used on playgrounds. They were used on roadways to tampen down dust. So that went into the groundwater when they used them in that format. So, yes, all the scenarios you could possibly think of, that's how the PCBs got into the river. And the biggest insult to the Hudson River actually came when a dam was breached in the upper Hudson. And there was a huge buildup right outside the factories where the PCBs were being manufactured. And that's a Superfund site that's being managed by New York State. And they're doing extremely well, almost non-detect down inside of the bedrock and below the factory levels. But when that dam was breached, the Allen Mill event, they call it, just millions of tons of sediment contaminated with PCBs flew right down into the upper Hudson and down over the Troy Dam and down into the lower Hudson River.
So there's really no way to tell how much PCB went into the river.
The rough estimate is, like I said, and I took an exercise. You have to go through thousands of boxes of court document said, because this was a Supreme Court decision, and General Electric kept records of their mixture. It's a mixture that was mixed specifically for General Electric. We call it GE's Aerochlors. It's as distinct almost as a fingerprint, that General Electric used this type of PCBs in their manufacturing process. And you can start adding up numbers of, we use this much PCBs and this many transformers and this much was waste product, and then you start doing this addition and subtraction. Conservatively, 5 million pounds is unaccounted for. More closely, probably closer to 9 million pounds is unaccounted for in the paper trail, which means it went out as some form of waste.
Wow. And so what has been the reaction since the report has come out? Is there movement in Albany? I mean, the Senate is now controlled by Democrats. Is there movement in Albany on PCBs in the Hudson River this coming term?
Well, it's interesting that this is, like I said, PCBs are very toxic and they're very non-discriminatory. So PCBs are a bipartisan issue. We've had really great champions from both sides of the aisle because this touches 14 communities across two states, and Governor Cuomo's administration actually stepped up to the plate and told EPA, we're not going to accept less than what the record of decision said. So we've been enjoying having champions on both sides of the aisle, so that's not been an issue, and we hope that the governor continues and DEC continues their firm stance in not allowing EPA to walk away or let General Electric walk away from the Hudson River until the job is done.
So the governor and some of the legislators have been criticized for being slow on water issues in Hoosick Falls and Nassau and Newburg, but you think they're up to speed on this issue?
We've seen it, yes, especially when at the end of the cleanup, when EPA and General Electric came out with their let's check our progress plan. And they said, we're going to gather 308 samples in the 40 miles of the river to check to see how contaminated the sediment is. In some cases, that was drawing up one bucket of mud every mile. How can you possibly scientifically say we're going to get an accurate picture of what the sediment looks like when you're doing such a scattered amount of sediment collection? And we want science to lead the way. We don't want this to be speculative. We want it to be led by science. So the governor did step up and say, let's get enough samples so we know what's going on in the river. So we hope that's going to continue, and we're pretty confident that the governor is going to support his and his department in making sure that we know what condition the river is in right now.
And I think you were saying before the EPA has been more of a problem. Is this a Pete Lopez issue?
No, Pete sort of walked into it and actually hit the pause button as he was coming up to speed on the science and the legalities of the cleanup. We were sort of on a track to let General Electric get their certificate of completion, and now we're not. So he's taking his time to understand it. He's asked his staff to coordinate closely with DEC on the data collection, and the hope being you're going to come to some kind of agreement. And for the lower Hudson River, I really would like to stress that the Superfund site is 200 miles long. If you want to talk about geographic scope, go on both sides of the river. So you're talking 400 miles of communities that are impacted by a 100-year legacy pollution problem. This has to be considered in the certificate of completion that EPA is contemplating, and it has to be considered in the 5-year review. The lower Hudson River doesn't even know that the dredging took place. The levels are so similar, almost baseline, to what they were prior to the dredging.
Wow.
So that's a problem. And we understand that, you can't get every molecule, and the lower Hudson River is a different animal. It's deeper, it's broader, and we don't necessarily know if the right technology that we use in the upper Hudson River would even work down here. What we do know is we need to understand the problem, and the lower Hudson River deserves to get the investigation that it needs. And we've been pressing EPA to take that step, and we hope that they will.
So you want them to do tests or studies?
An investigation, yes.
Yeah. And do they seem open to that, or...
They say yes. They say we're gathering studies. We're trying to decide what needs to be done. But it's not complicated. The Superfund program, believe it or not, as far as process goes, is very clear-cut. You order an RIFS, a remedial investigation feasibility study. You do that. It doesn't necessarily mean dredging. It doesn't necessarily mean anything other than we've determined that the Lower Hudson River received no benefit from General Electric's dredging project. So we need to understand what the problem is and if there is indeed a...
Song that we love to sing. Every time we hear the music and we're in this love together, we got the kind that lasts forever.
WGXC always needs computer donations. If you have an old one you don't need, and it's either a Macintosh 2011 or newer 2.0 gigahertz or faster CPU, dual core or more, or Windows 2012 or newer 2.4 gigahertz or faster CPU, dual core or more, email info@wgxc.org for more information.
Tune-in holiday specials this December on WGXC. At noon, Friday, December 14th, the annual Rockin' Ray Palmer Christmas Show is on live. Rockin' Ray Palmer returns to the WGXC Hudson studio, taking requests and playing Christmas favorites. At 7 p.m., Saturday, December 22nd, tune on for composer Phil Klein's Unsilent Night, performed live on the streets of Hudson. Find out more at WGXC.org or unsilentnight.com. At 5 p.m., December 24th, tune in for the Christmas Eve service live from the First Presbyterian Church in Hudson. All day Christmas Eve, December 24th, WGXC tunes in special NORAD reports at the top of the hour, tracking Santa's progress around the world.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by the First Presbyterian Church of Hudson, a faith community open to all. Whether you are single, married, divorced, gay, wealthy, poor, or no habla inglés, if you are just browsing, just woke up, or just got out of jail, it doesn't matter if you work on Wall Street or if you sleep on Wall Street, you belong. We love soccer moms, crying babies, vegans, hipsters, seekers and doubters, tourists and locals. All are welcome. Services held Sunday mornings at 10:45 a.m. You can find us on the web at firstpreshudson.org.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC Hands-On Radio News Update. I'm Philip Grant. The Daily Freeman is reporting U.S. Representative-elect Antonio Delgado announced December 10th the appointment of Athens resident Amanda Broomhauer as his district director. Broomhauer will oversee all district offices and constituent services, including representing Delgado at local meetings and events. She will bring approximately 10 years of public service experience to her new role. Broomhauer most recently worked as a special assistant in the New York State Office of General Services. She previously worked as a federal liaison for former U.S. Representative Maurice Hinchey, handling constituent inquiries concerning the U.S. Departments of State, Homeland Security, Defense, Veterans Affairs, and Education. Brumhauer has also worked as Deputy District Director for former U.S. Representative Scott Murphy, a position that included managing his regional office in Hudson. Read the full story in the Daily Freeman. Larry Rulison is reporting for the Times Union. Charter Communications is asserting the July vote by the Public Service Commission that forced the company to come up with a plan to sell off its Spectrum cable TV and internet network imposed a, and I quote, draconian penalty, end quote, on the company that was also, and I quote, unprecedented and unlawful, end quote, and caused, and I quote, irreparable, end quote, harm to the company. Lawyers for Charter wrote in a filing made with the PSC last month that seeks to hold off the PSC's action against the company, and I quote, the commission's actions are also unconstitutional, end quote. Both sides are working on a compromise that would keep Charter in New York and end the ongoing feud over whether the company has been in compliance with the conditions of its 2016 acquisition of Time Warner Cable. The filing came at about the same time that Charter and staff at the PSC notified the commission that the two sides had put together a settlement framework. The biggest issue had been Charter's obligation to build out its high-speed broadband network in New York and how quickly and where the construction should take place. So far, Charter has filed an exit plan outlining how it plans to sell the Spectrum network and wind down its operations in the state. PSC has agreed to extend the deadline as the two sides held negotiations to reach a settlement. And you can read that full story in the Times Union. MidHudsonNews.com is reporting neo-Nazi flyers have been discovered at SUNY Purchase. Governor Andrew Cuomo said December 10th he is, and I quote, disgusted and will not tolerate the toxic social dynamic that is spreading like a cancer across the country and fueling hateful material like the neo-Nazi flyers that were found on this campus, end quote. The governor has directed the State Police Hate Crimes Unit to assist in the investigation. U.S. Representative Nita Lowey, a Democrat representing New York's 17th District, said she was, and I quote, deeply troubled, end quote, to learn of the posters, and I quote, especially as Jews across the world came together for the Festival of Lights, a celebration of the triumph of the Jewish people over persecution, end quote. Read the full story at MidHudsonNews.com. And that wraps up the WGXE Hands-On Radio News Update. For local weather reports, public meetings, and other community information, use the WGXE website, wgxc.org. From the WGXE Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a pleasant tomorrow. Next, we have these reports.
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
The National Audubon Society is a nonprofit environmental organization dedicated to conservation. Sharon Bruce is the communications manager for Audubon New York and Connecticut. Thanks for joining us, Sharon.
Thank you.
Am I saying that wrong? I feel like I said that
wrong.
No,
you're great. Audubon New York and Audubon Connecticut.
Could you give us a brief overview of what the Audubon Society is and what you do as an organization?
Yeah, sure. The Audubon Society is actually a national network. There are state programs. So I'm managing communications for two state programs, but it's an incredible nationwide effort to protect birds and the places they need.
Most people associate the Audubon Society with birds, but much of your work has little to do with birds. What's something most people don't know about the society?
That's a fair statement. Again, Audubon works to protect birds and the places they need. So the way we see it is there are lots of different places across the country that birds rely on, different habitats from the coast to the forests to the mountains, plains. There are different birds in all of these places. And, you know, birds rely on very key places for food and to rest during migration. We call these important bird areas. So what we're doing is we are working on the ground in communities with local people to protect the places that birds need in order to support wildlife. So here in Connecticut and in New York, we work out on Long Island, Long Island Sound. We work throughout thousands of acres of forest. We have centers in Greenwich, in Syracuse, and you know, those are places where people can come and experience what we do in real life.
So what are some of the issues specific to New York State that you deal with?
So, I mean, there are issues that are specific to New York State, but really, we're dealing with the same issues that you see nationwide. Climate change is a huge issue that we're dealing with on a nationwide scale. The thing is, it's affecting our local birds here in New York State. So overall, there are 314 species Audubon has found that are threatened by global warming. So our work on the ground here is to, again, protect the places that birds really rely on from, you know, everything from development to there are issues with sea level rise on the coast. So if we can protect those places, even though we are also dealing with a changing climate, then it's possible that we can support this, you know, incredible wildlife population a little bit better through the changes.
Do you, does the Audubon Society, do you service like urban areas, or is this mostly kind of like woodland type projects that you're working on?
So we have five primary focuses. We focus on the coast. We focus on what we call working lands, which involves forests and farms. We have a program called Bird Friendly Communities, and that is in urban areas and suburban areas. We go into schools and we help them build green bird-friendly gardens using native plants. We, you know, help build community gardens at local churches. I know you guys have a community garden here. We'd be happy to help you think about what plants could help bring more birds to the garden and, you know, bigger variety of species. And then we work on climate initiatives and water initiatives. So, you know, we see these, a lot of these initiatives as affecting people in both urban and suburban areas, and so we're everywhere so that we can help everyone. And you know, birds exist as much in urban as in suburban areas as they do on farms and in forests.
So personally, what is your relationship with birds been, and how did you get involved with the Audubon Society originally?
Yeah, so I was very interested in conservation. I had worked at a couple different nonprofits doing marketing and communications before, and I wanted to merge the two interests. So I ended up in an agency, and one of my clients was Audubon, and so I learned about them sort of from the outside. And through my work at the agency, I had to, you know, post on social media about birds and write emails about birds. And, you know, at first I was writing like 1,000 emails a day. Can someone identify this bird? Can someone tell me what this bird is doing in this photo? And finally started getting the hang of it. And it just, it really opened up a whole new world to me, you know, related to wildlife conservation and what's going on in our natural world.
Is there anything that we haven't asked you that you'd like to talk about?
Well, Audubon does have a really cool initiative coming up. It's called the Christmas Bird Count. So this is a bird-related community science effort. So it's critical to understanding how birds are responding to our changing climate. Essentially, you go on to christmasbirdcount.org and you find a a leader who is counting birds near you. And there are events happening between December 14th and January 5th. And so people count birds and they put all this data into, you know, a database. And then scientists can look at the data and better understand how birds migrate and what birds are spending time here in the winter and why there might be more of certain birds versus others. And we can learn a lot about, you know, how birds are affected by climate change as a result.
Do you have the answers to any of those questions now? What are there species of birds or certain places that we might have heard of that that you're particularly interested in?
Yeah, on our coasts, Audubon, one of Audubon's priority species is the piping plover. So mostly because of, you know, development and people who love the beach, as most of us do, piping plovers don't have the safe places to nest. They nest in these little, like if you or I took three fingers and we just dug a little hole in the sand, like an inch deep, that's their nest. And, you know, so because of sea level rise, because of just humans being around, those birds have trouble fledging chicks every year. So we're working really hard on our coast to support piping plovers. In our forests, we're supporting wood thrushes, for instance. Again, like I said, birds like all different kinds of habitats. So we have to figure out how to not just protect, but create habitats that can sustain them.
Can I ask how you count birds? Is it through nests or?
That's a great question. Yeah. So obviously on the coast, it's a little bit easier because beach birds, seabirds are a bit bigger. But the way the Christmas bird count works, for instance, is everyone is assigned a 15-mile range, which is humongous and it takes a lot of people. But you really do just go out and you tally up the most amount of birds of a particular species that you see at one time. So, you know, you wouldn't just sit there and say, oh, there's a bluebird, and then 10 minutes later say, oh, there's a bluebird, because it could be the same bluebird. So if you see five bluebirds at one time, you count them. You just go out there with binoculars. A lot of people are birders by ear, so they can hear birds and then count them. That's a whole level of expertise that I have yet to reach.
Maybe one day, though.
Right? Oh, yeah, working definitely on working on it.
Excellent.
Well, thanks so much for coming in and talking with us, Sharon.
Thank you. Yeah. If you want to know more about Audubon, we use the hashtag BirdsTellUs online. And then Audubon Connecticut is at ct.audubon.org. Audubon New York is at ny.audubon.org. And we're on all the social medias.
Well, thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.
That interview was from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
Here are some more headlines from WOOCLP, WGXC's partner station in Troy.
The Albany County Airport Authority Board approved a $55.3 million budget for the coming year that indicates a series of capital improvements, as well as a new 1,000-car parking garage and various terminal renovations.
The murder of an 18-year-old woman in Hudson Falls and the police investigation that followed will be examined on a true crime TV show Tuesday. Investigation Discovery's series Body Cam profiles real-life police work using footage captured on officers' body-worn cameras as they respond to 911 calls across the United States.
The family of Amanda Rivenberg has filed a notice of claim with the State Court of Claims alleging the state is responsible for the October 6th limo crash on Route 30 in Schoharie County that killed 20 people. The lawsuit accuses the state of failing to improve the treacherous intersection where the crash occurred.
Upstate New York U.S. representatives introduced legislation Tuesday to close a loophole in law that allows stretch limousines to avoid compliance with federal regulations after the Schoharie limo crash that killed 20 in October. Currently, stretch limousines are aren't subject to the same safety regulations, like seatbelt requirements, as other new vehicles for sale. They can skirt requirements and avoid compliance with the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration regulations. Stephen Ainley, who was Union College president for 12 years starting in 2006, was recorded to have earned almost $2.3 million in total compensation, according to most recent data compiled by the Chronicle of Higher Education.
Temperatures in the Arctic are warming more than twice as fast as the overall planet's average temperature, with temperatures this year in the highest latitudes above 60 degrees north coming in 1.7 degrees Celsius, that's 3.1 degrees Fahrenheit, above the average for 1981 to 2010. These were the second warmest, behind 2016, air temperatures ever recorded during the Arctic year, which runs from October through September to avoid splitting the winter season. President Donald Trump met with the top House and Senate Democrats over funding for the border wall and the prospects of a government shutdown publicly clashing on Tuesday. A lot was said during the tense meeting between Donald Trump, House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, but Vice President Pence stayed silent during the exchange.
You have the vote. You should pass it.
No, we
right
don't have
now.
The vote, Nancy, because in the Senate we need 60
no,
votes.
No, but in the House.
And we don't
you
have.
You could bring it up right now.
Yeah, but
today.
I can't. Excuse me.
The fact is, you do not have the votes in the House.
Nancy, I do. Right. And we need
well,
border security. Nancy.
We'll find out.
Nancy.
The Washington Post today gave you a whole lot of Pinocchios because they say you constantly misstate how much the wall is built, how much of the wall is built, and how much is there. But that's not the point here. We have a disagreement about the wall,
Washington
whether
Post.
It's effective or whatever. Not on borders. That's what we're urging you to do. Not threaten to shut down the government because
you.
Let me just finish. Because you can't get
the
your
last
way.
Time you shut it down. You
yeah.
Got killed.
Let me say. When the president brags that he won North Dakota and Indiana, he's in real trouble.
When I
did.
Let me say this.
We did win North Dakota
this
and
is
Indiana.
The most
I am proud to shut down the government for border security, Chuck, because the people of this country don't want criminals and people that have lots of problems and drugs pouring into our country. So I will take the mantle. I will be the one to shut it down. I'm not going to blame you for it. The last time you shut it down, it didn't work. I will take the mantle
Good.
Of shutting down. And I'm going to shut it down for border security.
But we
security.
Believe you shouldn't
okay.
shut it down.
Tune into all sorts of radio on the air Wednesday, December 12th at 9 a.m. on the WGXC Morning Show. We'll hear all about the Rensselaer Plateau Alliance from Jim Bonesteel and Annie Jacobs. We'll also hear from Laura Schindel of the Food and Water Watch and what they're doing to stop the expansion of fossil fuels in New York. And WOOC's Corinne Carey speaks with Albany County District Attorney David Sars about his recent decision to stop prosecuting low-level marijuana offenses. All that on the WGXC Morning Show before 11 a.m. Stella is in to get happy at 2:30 p.m. before the Radio Survivor Radio News Show at 3 p.m. Tune in at 4 p.m. for the WGXC Afternoon Show. Rashad Barksdale will talk about his It's Okay to Dream Santa giveaway program for children 12 and under. At 6 p.m., Robin Michalecki, a chronic pain patient and patient advocate, speaks with Heather Martin on the Medical Freedom Show during All Together Now. Democracy Now! Rounds up the international news at 7 p.m. on the radio on WGXC 90.7 FM.
Turn out, tune in, and ring in the new year with WGXC live at the Half Moon in Hudson. Come out for the annual fun at one of the busiest New Year's celebrations in the area. This year, things get started at 8 p.m. with karaoke hosted by Amanda Lees, followed by dancing to the music of the band Blueberry. And then, after midnight, DJ Vaugh from WGXC's Friday Night Vibe Session keeps the airwaves and the dance floor moving. The sliding scale contribution at the door helps keep WGXC on 90.7 FM in the new year. The Taste of India food truck will also be there, with a portion of their food sales going to benefit WGXC. And the entire event will be broadcast live on 90.7 FM and WGXC.org.
There are so many events on the WGXC community calendar online at WGXC.org.
www.jamboree.org. And you can add your own by pressing the Add an Event button right there on the page. If you do, folks like me will read your community event on the radio. Folks around the world will see it online at wgxc.org, including some of these events.
On Wednesday, December 12th, volunteer training for Literacy Connections will be held from 3:30 to 5:30 at the Hudson Area Library. More information at literacyconnections.org. Then, on Thursday, the 13th, work developed over the past 3 months by urban design students from Columbia University is displayed in Hudson Valley Visions in Hudson Hall at the historic Hudson Opera House from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. Join us Friday, December 14th, for Kath Bloom and Aisha Burns at the Root Cellar in Greenfield, Massachusetts at 7 p.m. Reverend Ronald Grant will be at Club Helsinki Hudson with an evening of sacred seasonal jazz beginning at 8 p.m. Lord Youth and Nick Pankin play at Hilo in Catskill at 8:30 p.m. And then on Saturday, the 15th, the City of Hudson Senior Center and Hudson Area Library will host Watercolor with Your Grandperson from 1 to 4 p.m. at Hudson Area Library. Ankrum Opera House's storytelling series, Real People, Real Stories, returns with the theme, The Kindness of Strangers, at 3 p.m. at the Ankrum Opera House. A Kwanzaa celebration will be held from 3:30 to 5 p.m. in Hudson Hall at the historic Hudson Opera House. Speed Sisters, screening with potluck at 6 p.m. and film at 7 p.m. at the Old Chatham Quaker Meeting House. Babel Gilberto performs at the Egg at the Empire State Plaza at 8 p.m. And High Time performs at the Half Moon in Hudson at 8 p.m. And then finally, on Sunday the 9th, Folk Tales and Stories Hour with Pamela DeBia is at 2 p.m. at the Hudson Area Library. The Blythewood Ensemble will play from 3 p.m. to 4 p.m. in Hudson Hall at the historic Hudson Opera House. Katie Mullins, Will Stratton, and Alexander Turnquist will be at the Half Moon in Hudson beginning at 7 p.m. That's it for this week's WGXE Community Calendar. You can add your own event and hear it right here on the radio by visiting WGXC.org and clicking on the calendar link at the top of the page.
Next, it's time for the Hudson Valley Song of the Day, a performance from a musician visiting the Capital Region or Hudson Valley, or who regularly plays around these parts.
I pulled into Nazareth, was feeling about half past dead. I just need some place where I can lay my head. Hey, mister, can you tell me where a man might find a bed? He just grinned and shook my hand. No was all he said. Take a load off.
Nothing wrong with your television set. Do not attempt to adjust the picture. We are controlling transmission. If we wish to make it louder, we will bring up the volume. If we wish to make it softer, we will tune it to a whisper. We will control the horizontal. We will control the vertical. We can roll the image, make it flutter. We can change the focus to a soft blur, or sharpen it to crystal clarity. For the next hour, sit quietly and we will control all that you see and hear. We repeat, there is nothing wrong with your television set. You are about to participate in a great adventure. You are about to experience the awe and mystery which reaches from the inner mind to the outer limits.
This is Echo. You are listening to WJFC Agra, Creative Community Magical Radio.
I'm a roadrunner, honey.
Thank you.